Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is by B. Wilson. I should have kept my kid's Elmer the Elephant plate. Then Aaron Mulvaney wrote, judges use AI to speed up the work behind decisions. Joseph Epstein has, we Epsteins deserve a break. We'll follow that up with an article by Charlie Nye, living by the numbers, my father got to 97. Mike Kerrigan wrote, where does hope rank? I take the fifth, and we'll do one more today by Bert Stratton, To Life, Marriage, and Wine. So let's begin with today's first article. All these are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal, and today's first one is, I should have kept my kid Elmer the Elephant plate. When the nights of feeding still drag and the days creep along like a slug, people will warn you with a knowing air that your baby's life will go so fast. But they don't tell you that the time will come when you stare into the cupboard where the Elmer the Elephant plate used to be kept and feel a small but insistent stab of loss. They say don't say that you will mourn this garish and ugly melamine plate, which you rashly gave away during a clear out as if it were a dead pet. They don't tell you that. Missing this plate and other related accessories of toddlerdom, you too will become someone who meets new parents and feels an urge to warn them that it goes all so fast, as if the warning could somehow stop the onward rush of time. You can spend a long time obsessing about a baby's first spoon, plate, or bowl. We also had various utensils involving Miffy, the bunny rabbit. These items are receptacles of love and applesauce. The particular choice of pattern or cartoon character for that first plate is a decision that feels weighty but pleasurable. There's an easy act of courtship, such as buying flowers for a lover, but one whose love you already feel secure in. I considered the options for my son's first plate. I discounted princess plates, although now I wonder if I was just imposing my own ideas of what a boy should like. I was tempted by farm animals and dinosaurs in space. Would it perhaps be wise to plant the idea of being an astronaut in his head as early as possible? In the end, Elmer the Patchwork Elephant deemed the friendliest, least controversial decision. With its many colors, it had a be-whatever-you-want-to-be kind of vibe. During early parenthood, you are always buying for the next stage. When I got that Elmer plate, the idea that my son could ever actually be advanced enough to understand the words in one of the Elmer board books felt like a wondrous dream. It seemed just enough to be looking at this creature on the plate and trying and failing to say elephant. And then suddenly, he was old enough for me to read him the Elmer books. The one we read the most was Elmer's Colors. Through Elmer, we considered the white of snowmen and the purple of scarves, the pink of strawberry ice lollies, and the red of sunset. There was a page where Elmer balances an orange and a lemon on his trunk. Don't drop them, Elmer. We could relate to this. We were habitually dropping things, including the Elmer plate itself. Melamine may not be the most elegant material, but I was grateful for the fact that, no matter how violently a one-year-old dropped that plate, it would bounce and not shatter. The same could not be said for the food. I could not count the times I took that plate and lined up things in on it, things my son could eat with his fingers or a fork if we were lucky. Tiny florets of broccoli that looked like trees, farfalla with pesto, oily, moss-soaked butterflies, tiny meatballs, tiny fish cakes, fragments of chicken, cubes of roast potato and roast sweet potato, things which I hoped would please him and give him a balanced diet, whatever that is. He was easy to feed, but struggled with sleep, and by late afternoon, we were often both exhausted, hence the endless dropping of things. Over time, the Elmer plate lost most of its original sense of excitement. It became just another thing that went in and out of the dishwasher every day. We were still using it long after my son had moved on to Spider-Man and the Hulk. It was only after his sister was born and became old enough for solid food that the Elmer plate stopped being his and became hers. All over again, I was lining things up on its smooth and colorful melamine surface. She was a fan of hard-boiled eggs and slices of fresh avocado, and she, too, loved to read about the pink of strawberry ice lollies and the red of sunsets and the orange of oranges. Someone gave her a plate with purple flowers on it, but the Elmer one was her old familiar favorite until it got passed on to her younger brother. And then one day, no one in the family needed it. They had all graduated to real plates, and I gave it away. I didn't understand then that it was possible to hanker deeply after something that is neither pretty nor useful just because of the person who once used it. The fact that no one needs it anymore is exactly what makes the wanting so fierce, because it reminds you of a time when you were needed too. Children change and grow, but the left behind plate stays the same. It is the nature of childhood possessions that the child is always outgrowing them, and this is how things are meant to be. We are constantly being weaned or weaning ourselves from one thing to another, and this means leaving other things behind. From liquids to solids, from toy trains to Nintendo, from Harry Potter to Lord of the Flies. As a parent, you wouldn't want your child to be stuck forever wearing a onesie and drinking from a sippy cup. The boy for whom I bought that Elmer plate is now in his 20s and going to work each day in a much more challenging job than I've ever done without any help from me. He is so many stages beyond the phase of life when I would speak to him in a sing-song voice about patchwork elephants that it's laughable even to think of it. He has a beard. But there is part of you that never forgets the sweet, sweaty way a toddler's head used to smell after a nap, how he hesitated quizzically after he dropped something to see if you would mind. Because sometimes you were so tired that you did mind and couldn't quite summon up the energy to hide it. And you remember how something in his expression made you laugh involuntarily, even though by this point of the day, you just wanted dinner time to be over already, and for this person, much as you loved them, to be asleep and out of your life for a few hours, and you picked the Elmer plate up off the floor and started again. And now, judges use AI, artificial intelligence, to speed up the work behind decisions. Federal Judge Xavier Rodriguez uses artificial intelligence to help manage a daunting case backlog in his San Antonio courtroom, deploying it to summarize legal filings, decipher the facts, and write questions to lob at lawyers during hearings. AI has a somewhat dubious reputation in the legal world, where lawyers in recent months have drawn ridicule and reprimand for submitting briefs riddled with citations to factual cases and factual errors. Judges whose decisions carry grave power to reshape people's lives have served more frequently as referees of the technology than early adopters. But a growing contingent of judges are increasingly embracing AI to help them draft opinions, analyze court filings, and quickly conduct legal research. The cat is out of the bag, said Rodriguez, who said he always makes the final decision in cases himself. We need to be heading into the future. Rodriguez, who has been on the bench since 2003, first used AI experimentally to see how it would have adjudicated a 7-week trial he had recently completed. In deciding the case involving Texas election law, he and his law clerks had sifted through hundreds of thousands of exhibits, reviewed testimony from more than 70 witnesses, and researched relevant case law. The entire process took 10 months before the judge issued a 140-page opinion. Out of curiosity, he ran that same evidence through an AI tool. Within minutes, the computer had produced a first draft that included the findings of fact that had taken his team weeks to produce. While the final result wasn't perfect and needed some fact-checking, Rodriguez has been using AI ever since. Technology companies are marketing AI to court systems as a time saver that can help provide better access to justice for litigants. Some of the largest players in the legal research industry, including Thomas Reuters and LexisNexis, are developing AI tools for use by lawyers and judges. Lexis product is now available to all federal court judges. AI startup Learned Hand, whose product is designed specifically for judges, has active pilots in 10 states, mostly involving state courts, including the Michigan Supreme Court, as well as one federal court. Founder Shlomo Clapper, a Yale law graduate who worked as a law clerk for a New York federal appeals court, said he saw a business opportunity to target court systems, while many of his competitors have focused more heavily on marketing AI products to law firms. Despite concerns about the use of AI, Clapper argues that the public benefits when business disputes are resolved more quickly, divorces are completed, and criminal trials concluded. State courts, which handle about 97% of all cases in the country, are particularly overburdened and have fewer resources. There's a point where not using these tools is doing harm, Clapper said. At the same time as judges are gradually embracing the use of AI, they are quickly trying to come up with rules for use of the new technology by lawyers. Some judges have banned lawyers from using AI in their courtroom entirely. Lawyers have been sanctioned in a number of instances for submitting inaccurate information generated by AI, including one Florida lawyer who was fined $85,000. Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, last year admonished two federal judges who used AI to write opinions with factual errors, including naming fictitious litigants, citing non-existent sworn declarations, and attributing quotes to people who deny ever saying them. These do not appear to be simple slips of the pen or mechanical oversights, but substantive errors that undermine confidence in the court's deliberative process, Grassley wrote in letters to the judges. In response, the judges acknowledged AI was used to craft the opinion, but told the center they had implemented corrective measures to verify accuracy. Most judges emphasize that while they are using AI to speed up certain aspects of their jobs, they continue to make the final decisions themselves. Judge Allison Goddard, a magistrate judge in Southern California, uses AI tools to edit opinions, prepare a list of questions to ask lawyers at hearings, and summarize portions of briefs in her written rulings. Goddard has tiptoed into using AI to draft opinions with her oversight. She used AI tools to create a database with all of her orders in cases involving Social Security appeals, training it to learn the legal standard she uses in deciding cases. Now, with new appeals, the tool creates a summary of the arguments and a chronology of key events, as well as maps out a framework for making a decision. In limited instances, AI is beginning to replace human educators. The American Arbitration Association introduced an AI arbiter last year that can generate decisions in construction-related disputes. It was trained on more than 1,500 past decisions to predict how a human would have ruled. Individuals or businesses in arbitration, a dispute process that happens outside a courtroom, can opt to use the AI generator. The tool can generate a decision much more quickly than human arbitrators, said Bridget McCormick, the AAA chief executive and a former chief justice of the Michigan Supreme Court. Since it launched, the AAA has been flooded with requests to use the tool, McCormick did say. And now, we Epstein deserve a break, this one by Joseph Epstein. I know someone more angry than Donald Trump to put an end to the controversy surrounding the Jeffrey Epstein files. Me. I, Joseph Epstein, have grown weary of hearing my surname mentioned in connection with the odious activities of the late pedophile and pimp Jeffrey Epstein. The Epstein name derives from the German town of Epstein in Hesse, though most of us have Eastern European heritage. So common is our name that I sometimes think of Epstein as the Jewish Smith. When I was a young man in New York literary circles, I was often asked after being introduced, any relation to Jason Epstein? Jason Epstein was a powerful figure, the co-founder of the New York Review of Books and a key figure at Random House, where he must have rejected a million manuscripts by a million aspiring writers. When I answered, no relation, the response was often, good, I hate that, several expletives deleted. Today, I'm much more pleased to announce that I am no relation to Jeffrey Epstein. At least Jeffrey Epstein and I pronounce our common last name differently. He was an Epstein and I am an Epstein. The Steen-Stein distinction came about during World War I when anti-German feeling was so great that sauerkraut was called Liberty Cabbage and some American symphony orchestras refused to play Beethoven. Many Steins went ahead and steamed themselves to avoid the Germanophobia. Others refused to drop their Steins. Leonard Bernstein, I am told, would get ticked to the max if you pronounce his name Bernstein. Steenie or Steinie, I can live with either because I chose Stein because it emphasized my Jewishness, of which I happen to be proud. Epstein is, of course, a Jewish name. When I was 6 or 7, my father told me that there are people in the world who might hate me just because of my name, like me as a Jew. Jeffrey Epstein must have been a nightmare for the Anti-Defamation League. With his big money, powerful connections, and freaky sexual habits, he was an anti-Semite stream. Fair to say that the Trump administration has thus far bungled its handling of the Jeffrey Epstein finding, allowing anyone to imagine really who might be on the total list. As National Review notes, everyone has built vast castles of fantasy atop the Epstein case. That includes many members of his administration. Attorney General Pam Bondi and Federal Bureau of Investigation Director Cash Patel among them. Now President Trump is on the back foot with demands in Congress that he may release all files related to Epstein at the Justice Department. On social media, he says he has asked Ms. Bondi to produce any and all pertinent grand jury testimony subject to court approval. I hope that happens soon, if only so that I and the roughly 12,000 American Epsteins can once again live in peace. And now Charlie Nye, living by the numbers, my father got to 97. I recently turned 74. It's a long time to be around, but it's only 3/4 the length of my father's life. He died back in 2009 at 97, his mind as sharp as ever. In his long career as a labor estimator for General Motors, he spent his days working with numbers and his nights playing with numbers in his head. He could figure mental calculations extremely well. In his diary, Dad recorded important numbers. He wrote down monthly water meter readings and the mileage on vehicles at oil changes. But there were other, more sentimental entries, anniversaries and birthdays, was the number of years since a long-deceased family member had been born, married, or died. Wedding anniversaries are big markers to remember, especially for harmony in one's own marriage. I have no problem remembering mine, thanks to a fortunate numerical line. My wife and I were married back on May 6, 1978, or 5/6/78. It wasn't chosen on purpose, but I did ask my fiancée if she wanted the ceremony to begin at 12:34, 1, 2, 3, 4 in the afternoon. She did not. I have thought 12:34, 5, 6, 7, 8 had a nice ring to it. Numbers don't preoccupy me as much as they did my father, but I still find them fascinating. I understand something better when it is attached to a numerical value. A number represents an ordering, a rendering of perspective. Several years ago, I came across a pictograph depicting a 100-year human life in months. It has row after row of tiny circles, 36 across. Each circle represents 1 month, and one row represents 3 years of life. There are 34 rows from top to bottom, the last of which is one-third the length of the others. You can pinpoint where you are in the mass of circles at any given month of life. At 74, I jumped into the 889th of the 1,200 circles and am moving through the 25th row like clockwork. My father made it all the way to the 33rd row, the last full row of circles. As I begin to ponder how extraordinary my father's longevity was, I wanted a number. Research showed that only 2% to 3% of males born in the United States in the early 1900s survived to 97 like my dad did. He outlived every childhood friend but one and all of his 12 siblings and half-siblings. The path leading to my old age was a long one, but I don't feel 74. I still remember my college days and chums as clearly as when I was 24. After all, age is just a number. And now, where does hope rank? I take the fifth. Tragedy plus time equals comedy, according to the adage. I found a corollary. Sadness plus exhaustion equals laughter. Often holds true, and you don't have to wait long. A recent exchange with my youngest daughter illustrates this. The day of my father's funeral had been draining, but after the funeral mass, rite of committal, and reception, it was finally time to go home. Hope, 20, had volunteered to stay at a nearby hotel because my mother's house was stuffed with out-of-town relatives. As I dropped her off, Hope hugged my neck and said, "You're the best dad in the world." It was just what I needed to hear. I tried to reciprocate, which would have been easy under normal circumstances, but these were not normal circumstances. "Thanks, love," I answered. "You're tied for fifth." The perplexed look on her face instantly confirmed the faux pas. Being a father of five, I'm conditioned to say that all my kids are tied for first. Yet what my brain intended, my mouth failed to execute. Fifth tied for first is very different from one tied for fifth. "Been a long day," I said warmly. "You know what I meant." Hope shrugged as she exited the car. I laughed myself to much needed tears as I watched her enter the Hilton Garden Inn. Not only had I ranked Hope at rock bottom, by putting her in a tie for last, I was saying she was one of two undifferentiated children, so subpar that neither even merited fourth place. It was not one of my better salutations. Hope has a good ear for comedy and has already gotten mileage out of my blunder. She recently shared news of a good grade from college. "Not bad," she said, "for your tied for worst kid." I expect in the coming years, I'll hear that often and deservedly so. Now we do have another one. To life, marriage, and wine. I convinced my wife to go to synagogue, which is a hard sell. My come on was the wine. The first Saturday of the month, our synagogue passes out free bottles of Israeli kosher wine to married couples celebrating anniversaries that month. Two friends recently called to say they were separating from their spouses. I look for reinforcement for the institution of marriage whenever I can find it. Alex and I stood on the bima altar with eight other couples while congregants sang along to Simitov and Mazel Tov, good luck and congratulations. Rabbi Joshua Scott announced the winner in the anniversary derby, a couple celebrating 55 years of matrimony. Everybody read from the supplementary prayer book. These couples have come to the synagogue to give thanks for the institution of marriage and for their mutual love and devotion. One married man had a gray ponytail. There was an accountant in a suit and an obstetrician in a red pantsuit. The Torah portion was from Genesis. The rabbi noted that because Adam and Eve sinned, we're all going to die, which makes things interesting because if we live forever, we'd never get around to doing anything. Why would you diet if you can put it off for 500 years? Our marriage boosting interlude ended with, may it be God's will that these married couples continue to live to a ripe old age together in happiness, lightening each other's burdens, and reaping a harvest of joy from the seeds of love they have sown in the hearts of their family. To life and free wine. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.